Greetings, Raise community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Rick Virgin, who serves as Vice President for University Advancement at the University of San Diego. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, and I appreciate the invitation. Looking forward to the conversation today.
I love talking to people from San Diego because I never have to ask how the weather is, because we know it's perfect every day, so we can find other small talk. But I'll dive right into today's interview. And Rick, as I have asked our nearly 200 guests now on the Raise podcast, take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that, Rick? What was he into? And what led you to Ithaca College?
Yeah, I was obsessed with music and tennis. And like most 16, 17 year old guys, I was not completely self-aware, a little self-obsessed, as teens often are at that age. And
Tell me more. I want to be in your head. What music were you listening to?
So I was very much into jazz and classical music and rock, but I was a band kid, right? And so I was both in the jazz band. I was a concert band person. I was a marching band person, and so I was the sort of odd mix of being a high school athlete in tennis, but also being in band. I was a band kid, so I had this very mixed life in high school of being with kind of two sort of wildly different groups from one another. And
I love it, Rick. I got to say, well, first of all, where were you at this time?
So I switched high schools in the middle, which I don't recommend, by the way. I give that 0 out of 5 stars. So I switched from sophomore to junior year. We moved from the middle of Illinois, a place called Decatur, Illinois. We moved from there to the coast of Connecticut, and I finished high school starting from my junior year in a place called East Lyme, Connecticut, right on the coast. And so two very different cultures, two very different areas, two very different high schools. High school was a very unique experience for me because of that experience alone. I was really looking forward to going off to college. I thought I was going to be a music educator. Then I thought I would be, I took an accounting class in high school, loved it. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go to Ithaca College, going to be an accounting major, going to make, I forgot what the starting salaries were for accountants, when they graduated from college at that point. I was going to work at the time, one of the big eight firms. I was like, that's my path. I'm going to do that. And I had said out loud that I would never work in anything having to do with education or hospitals or, medicine, anything like that, because my mom was a nurse. My dad was an elementary school principal. And so I'd grown up with all of those things. And I was like, yeah, I don't want any of that. And here I am at my fourth university, having worked in higher education for years now. And all of those universities, by the way, have had either minor or major health sciences imprints, and two had nursing schools. So, it's one of those things like whatever you say you're not going to do in life, you sometimes wind up doing. So to the younger folks in the audience, be careful with the bold statements you make at a young age, because they might come back later at you in ways you don't expect.
I think what's fascinating is that you had actually given it a lot of thought. You had a plan. I'm going to go to Ithaca. Here's my vision. Yep. This is where I want to get to. Here's what I don't want to do. And here we are. So tell me more about the experience at Ithaca, and when on your journey, maybe that well-defined path started to twist and turn.
Yeah, it was very early on. Two things happened. Well, probably three things happened. One is I wound up taking a course in politics early on in my tenure at Ithaca. And of course, I had to take required classes in the business school there. And so, of course, I took one of the first accounting classes. Well, I hated the accounting class. And by the end of the semester, I was like, Oh my goodness. There's just no way I could do this for a living. I really would have to. And I could see the students around me. Most of them were really enjoying the classwork and the dialogue with the teacher. And the teacher was the professor was great. And so it wasn't like, he was awful or anything like that. He was good. And so this was all about me. I was like, okay, I think I really hadn't been thoughtful enough about what this was. This politics class I really enjoyed. And then I became an accidental student athlete in college. I wound up being on the crew team my freshman year. I didn't know what rowing or crew was. I wound up going down and trying out for the team, made the team. And so, I had this experience of understanding what teamwork really looked like in a very different setting than music in high school and tennis in high school. This was a very intensive experience rowing in college. I think college is a D3 school, but the sports there are very, very competitive. I would call it a very sporty campus. And the folks I was on the team with and the coaches that I had were so good. It was a great community. So I had these sort of three different experiences happening all at the same time. Of course, I was making friends on campus, living in the residence halls and the dorms and all of that. So there were a lot of things going on. And it occurred to me, I liked business. It wasn't going to be accounting. I liked politics. I think I needed to explore more of that. And this idea around teamwork, and if you've ever been in a boat, in a crew shell, you've got eight individuals in a shell. And each has, you're each holding on to an oar. You've got to balance the boat, and you've got a coxswain sitting in the front. He or she is sort of giving direction and steering the boat. You have to be wildly in sync, and you have to concentrate on setting the boat, and the oars have to go in the water at the same time and come out and at the same time. And it is a very synchronized sport, and the idea of the things that I learned from that time and that experience, I can't tell you how strong of an impression that made on me to this day, in lots of different ways. And so those experiences at Ithaca, and the friends that I made and the professors that I had were really pivotal to who I am today in many respects.
I love that story. And I have to say, I didn't have much exposure to crew. Although let's call it 8, 9 years ago, I was in Boston and there's a venture capitalist in Boston who named Jeff Busgang, an early friend and mentor of mine as I was on the Evertrude journey. And Jeff put together an event where his firm essentially recruited different entrepreneurs from the Boston startup community to compete against each other in rowing, our own little crew team with virtually zero prior experience, a couple of practices early mornings before work, and then just throw us out there as part of their sponsorship of a nonprofit in Boston called Community Rowing. And it was a complete fiasco, as you can imagine. We were not quite as in sync as you were describing, but it really gave me at least some empathy for what a beautiful sport it is. And I also just got to imagine, I remember in college, I played football and we would have these 6 a.m. practices on Tuesday morning, and people would always say, "Wow, that must be really hard." And I said, "You know what? When I'm walking into the gym at 6, the crew team's walking out. They're done." And so, and I don't think anybody worked harder than the crew team.
No, it was get up at 5 in the morning, which, when you're in college is nearly impossible. And Ithaca is situated up on top of this hill, and the Cayuga Lake is down at the bottom. So you're kind of running sort of almost 2 miles downhill to the boathouse. Then you're getting in the boat doing practice, and then you're running back uphill. This sounds like a story. It's some 85-year-old person. It's like, we walked up both ways, but you get up to campus, and then you can't eat enough food. I remember actually falling asleep in one of my 8 o'clock classes. It was a tiered class, and thank God they had the barriers in front. And I was so tired. I literally just was like, I'm just gonna seep down here when the professor had turned around, and I'm just gonna lay down for just a quick second. And then next thing you know, My classmate who was sitting next to me, this young woman, she was waking me up, and she was like, "Class is over." She's like, the other class, and I was like, oh, it was embarrassing. So yeah, it was that sport was it did a lot to me and for me.
So formative experience, how did that help shape your first step out of college?
I tried to think about the things that were important to me, and initially went into the financial planning sector, which I actually really enjoyed. But realized I didn't want to do it for the rest of my life. And even though I have great interest in the markets and investments, stocks, mutual funds, bonds, et cetera, all of those things. And so I was trying to figure out what it would be where I would feel inspired that I would be able to work as part of a team. And that's really what started to lead me to a couple of different jobs, and then my first job in higher education at the George Washington University, and leaving Connecticut, moving down to DC. And working in a place where I did feel inspired, I did feel like I was part of a team. I did feel like, similar to crew, that we were having to put the oars in the water at the same time. That there were many different interest areas within the university that excited me, and that we raised money for, and then I could be a part of that. And so, those things sort of led me to this career, and I didn't know what fundraising was.
Well, yeah, and my understanding
No
is you
idea.
kind of stumbled into it accidentally through volunteer work.
Yeah, I was volunteering at a children's museum in Connecticut, and one of the board members came up to me and months after I started volunteering there, and it was great because you get to see the kids and the families come in and do all sorts of things. And they the one of the board members approached me and said, "Hey, we need somebody to do development, and we'd like you to consider doing that." And I was like, "Development? I had literally just been with the kids working at like the arts and crafts table like that day and doing things, and I was like, what? Are they talking about developing pictures, like color, black and white?" And they said, no, fundraising." And I was like, "Oh, fundraising. Okay.
Do
Yeah, I could probably do that."
you remember who that board member was?
I remember, yes, Jay Gina, and it was actually the another board member that I actually worked for at night. I was waiting tables, Andy Pappas, who owned the restaurant that I worked at. And he's just this phenomenal, phenomenal guy. Also somebody who is a great team leader. And so, that experience, being asked by him, it was something I felt like I couldn't turn down.
I love it. And so if they hadn't said that to you, you might not be on the podcast today, but that's life.
Yeah, maybe, and I might be on a different podcast, being a washed up major league soccer player at this point, or something else. I have no idea, but it certainly wouldn't have been this. I'm very fortunate. A lot of people my age got into development work by accident, so my story's not unique in that sense. For younger individuals, there is a path, there is a culture, there are things you can study. There's like folks at Indiana University, et cetera. That's very different than when I came out of college.
So tell me, take me back to your first year at George Washington. What was the scope of the work? When you think about what you loved about it, what was really challenging, what you would go back and say to that Rick, like what comes to mind?
There are a couple things that really stick with me today that are hugely important. Pat Cornell, she's the person who hired me at GW, she had asked me to come take a job working for her in this much, much, much larger environment. A university is wildly different than obviously this very tiny children's museum, and also I'd worked at a Catholic high school in Connecticut, which was also a very small, intimate environment. She said, "Come work for me as my executive assistant. You will learn everything. You will get to know everything about how university and university development works. You'll get to see sort of how the vice president, myself, and the others who are in leadership run a development shop at a university." And she said, "And if you do well, I will promote you. And you will wind up being in a frontline fundraising position again, like you've been before. But this is a different setup, and she convinced me, and frankly, it was one of the best things I could have ever done, because it did two things for me. One is, I did learn everything that she described from the Vice President Mike Wirth and from Pat and all of the people who were in leadership there. Steve Trachtenberg, who was the president of GW, who was a force to be reckoned with, one of the smartest, most savvy presidents that I had worked with. You know, there was a lot during that time that I learned about higher education, about what it's like to work at a private institution, what it's like to be at a very complex higher ed environment. The second thing is, as I'm sitting here today, Lisa Fernandez, who's my executive assistant, sitting just on the other side of this wall, I never forget the task and the burden that she has, A, to manage me, because that's a lot. So, but B, the point of communication and the front face that she is for our division, our university, the way that she communicates, the way that she lets me know, sometimes privately about things that are happening. Those things that I think I did and learned when I was working for Pat Cornell at GW are very present with me today. And I tell people who ask, you know, how did you get started? And I said, how did you get started in higher education and fundraising? And I tell them, I sat in Lisa Fernandez's seat. And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I also, for people who sit in Lisa's seat, because I've been there before, I have a great deal of respect. I have a great deal of care about what it is that they do, how they're being treated in the workplace, what does professional development look like for them, how are we thanking them? You know, just all of those things are very present with me today.
Tell me more about that relationship, that partnership, how you get the most out of that experience. It hasn't come up too often, but many people listening are maybe wondering, why does Rick feel so strongly about that, and sort of what does a great partnership look like between you and Lisa, for example?
Yeah, I think part of this is having open dialogue and communication, because we've built up our relationship to this point where there are things that she can push me on when she needs to. There are things that I can ask her to do on my behalf, so that she can put things better together than I can. I think also recognizing the strengths that the two of us have. She's much better at handling details and putting things together, much better at implementing a large number of things than I am. So I can think about something sort of big picture, and then I can talk to her or one of the other team members and say, this is what I'm thinking, this is what I think we should do. And she can help think through, all right, A, she will say, I will take care of it. Or she will say, this is what I think we should do, and you should probably talk to this person. Let me help put that together quickly. And so just realizing the strengths that she brings and the strengths that I have, and the gaps that we have, and putting those things together, I think that makes for a very effective team. Also just having a sense of humor about the absurdities of the workplace and the world. I mean, there's a lot of laughter that happens here, and I really like that, just because sometimes we just look at each other and we're just like, you know, Lisa will walk in here and she'll just be like, you're just never going to believe this. And then we'll just be like, oh my God. And we'll start laughing. And we go, okay. So what are we going to do about this crazy situation? And, you know, having that sense of broader picture of the wider world, and that what we do here is hugely important, but also there are certain things that happen that aren't that important that we really shouldn't let get to us, that we should just kind of let bounce off of us. She's really good at you know, helping, I think, both of us and the team sort of have balance in life. And, you know, we call Lisa the queen of fun here, because, you know, I basically told her, you're really good at planning our divisional parties, and like around Christmas and a Halloween potluck we do where most of the division dresses up. And I just told her, I was like, go do this thing and make people happy. And you know, we build community around that, and people love her, and they love being here in the workplace. You know, I dressed up as Deadpool this year, and she dressed up in full cut. She was an Oompa Loompa, and her outfit was next level. I mean, it was. And so just, you know, having that type of environment where we just lean into these things, have fun. She really is a leader in helping us have a very cohesive community. And so I don't overlook that. I'm grateful for it, and I'm trying to make sure that she knows that I'm a fan of that, and that she's empowered to do these things, and that there's a great benefit for all of us.
I love it. Well, Lisa, I hope you're listening and great job. Keep it up. Very, very compelling. And it makes me think my business partner, JD Beebe, who is the founder of Thank You, would always say something along the lines of, we can do very serious work without taking ourselves too seriously, and has a similar ability to bring the appropriate amount of levity to any situation.
No,
Tell
it's
me
yeah. So
about your move to George Mason. In particular, sometimes we have these walks down memory lane as it relates to career path, but you joined George Mason basically on the first day of the global financial crisis. And I think it seems like so long ago, but there are moments like that that occur. COVID was another one that I just have to ask, what was it like walking into that environment relative to more normal, let's call it macroeconomic context?
Yeah, I had just gotten there. Mark Broderick, who was the VP, and we had known each other at GW, and he had asked me to come be the associate vice president, and said that there was going to be a lot of change that was going to have to take place with the team. There was really going to be this huge overhaul. And then I got there, and within the next year, it was like mayhem. The bottom fell out of the market. We had this massive recession. People were sort of questioning, is our market-driven system, is our view of capitalism and how things work here in the United States, is that actually going to hold? And it wasn't like some sort of crazy panic. It was more of, man, we really probably should be looking and figure out how did we get into this place. And of course, from a fundraising perspective, we were going great guns trying to prepare for a campaign, and it was like, whoa, okay, this is worrisome, and we don't know what's going to happen with the markets. How long is it going to take to recover? Assuming we do, which we thought we would, but it was frightening. And a lot of people's retirement portfolios, of course, took a hit. The housing values of, I mean, it was awful, and people lost a lot of wealth. There was a lot of damage that happened, and so we just didn't know how we were going to go forward. And so we had to sort of ratchet back what we thought our initial projections were for some of the fundraising, and we planned, and we held our breath in many respects to see that we could, that the country could make it through, and that George Mason would be a player that would still be standing. And we had every confidence in that because of the public education system in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and our faith in that system, and how well the other universities, public universities there, are funded, and the public support around that. And so there was a lot of things I think we had going for us, but it was an awful moment, and just not knowing, like, are we going to be able to actually raise lots of money in the next 24 months, or is it going to look really awful? And just right, not knowing, it was really hard to live through that. So just it was a very challenging time. And my wife and I were brand new parents. Our daughter was born in 2008, and so here we are, newborn, first time parents, and we're just like, okay. It's like the world is crashing down around us. It's like, we're gonna figure this out, maybe, I guess. And just there were lots of moments. It was quite something.
Yeah, well, things, settle out, and I think it's always a balance, similar to, I think when COVID emerged and sort of market took a, similarly acute drop. But it's also interesting, and I think having interviewed other people that went through that global financial crisis context is the need doesn't go away, and in some cases the need becomes more acute, and so there's this balance of how do you be thoughtful and empathetic to the donors while also being really clear and confident in communicating the need and not sitting on our hands too much.
Right. Yeah, there was, I remember there were urgent calls for scholarships for students who were not going to be able to continue in school, and emergency funds for students who, whose parents had lost houses, and they were concerns about being homeless or housing insecure. I mean, there were lots of things. Food, my awareness about food insecurity on campus came up during this time that I really became very aware of. We had students who were like most college campuses, you run the risk of having a few students or more, sleeping in their cars, and which is not a great situation for them. And and thinking about their current on their bills, they're paying their tuition. They're able to cobble together enough money for books. They have some money for food, not really anything for housing. And so they've made the calculation, this investment is worth it. I'm going to sleep in my damn car. And which is awful, right? And so those things I became very aware of during that time. And as an administrator now, we're very mindful about those things that happen on our campus today. And we have to pay very close attention and ask students. And that's the entirety of, that's the landscaping crew, that's the public safety crew, that's the housekeeping crew, that's all of us. That's the development of alumni relations. So, it's not the responsibility of a single entity on campus. It's
Yeah.
not like, oh, student affairs should take care of that because they take care
Right.
of students. That's on everybody.
No, look, I think when people think about fundraising, philanthropy, capital campaigns, campaign kickoffs, the campaign pillars, it tends to be on the higher end of Maslow's hierarchy that
Right.
people imagine that the positioning is around, and
Absolutely.
rarely are we thinking about the fundamental base layer of the hierarchy of needs, and it's far more common than I realized. My first exposure was Kansas State University has been a long time, friends and customers of Evertrues, and they had an interesting twist on their giving day where they were one of the first institutions to say, look, we're not going to do an all-encompassing giving day with 50 different funding priorities and initiatives. We're going to pick one problem and try to solve that problem in one day. And so they picked food insecurity, and they have what's called the Cat's Cupboard, which is their Kansas State Wildcats food pantry. And basically, they're like, our giving day is going to eliminate food insecurity on campus, the end. And the message was so clear, but it was also so eye-opening to me because I had no idea that there was food insecurity on campus. And I'm sure that many alumni, friends, and supporters learned a lot about that being an issue. And so it's an example where I think so often we are forced to or feel compelled to have campaign or giving day initiatives that cover the entire spectrum, and as opposed to just solving one problem.
That is an amazing example too of a university thinking, okay, what is it that we're facing today? What is it we believe we can do? How do we communicate that? And then how do we do something about it? And I love that example, because it moves people, and it also creates awareness, like you said, about a problem that faces probably more people than we realize.
So you made the move from Decatur to Connecticut. You're now up and down the Eastern Seaboard.
Right.
How do you land at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska?
Yeah, it was I think it's okay for me to tell this story because I don't know many I don't really don't know the other people who are involved, but I had received an inquiry about the VP position at Creighton, and had a conversation, and then we decided, maybe this isn't really the right time. And the recruiter said, well, that's okay, because the search is really at the tail end. And I said, well, that's fantastic. So, we're happy where we're at. And then a week later, the recruiter called and said, hey, are you still interested in this position at Creighton? And we had put it to bed. I mean, we had sort of said, and I said, no, absolutely not. And not flippantly, I just instinctually responded that way. And I said, sorry, I said, I'm not trying to be rude. I said, we just kind of closed the book. I said, what happened? She said, well, I can't really talk about it. And I was like, oh, okay. So she said, well, look, let me touch base with you in a couple of days. And I called her back and I said, so realizing you can't say a whole lot about it, tell me how the university thinks it wants to move forward. And then the next thing you know, I was on a plane out to Omaha, Nebraska, and then we were moving, and it happened in a very short time frame. And really, Tim Lannon, the president of the university, was the one who I felt really called to work with this guy, and I really liked him. He really liked me, and he was and is a very adept fundraiser. He has some great leadership skills. He has a really good sense of humor. He actually just texted me this past weekend because we want to hear getting a transformational gift, and he was one of the first texts I got. Text messages I got, and it was from Tim. And so it just was I felt called and compelled to go after meeting the folks here and talking to him. And I thought, and my wife and I talked a lot about it and felt like, the Midwest would be a great place to raise our daughter at that time too. And so we packed up and left, and it was a big risk to do that sort of thing. But in the end, I'm now in this position at University of San Diego, and without having that experience at Creighton, I would not have wound up here. So these things sort of sometimes happen for a reason, even if that's not apparent at the time.
And how did the opportunity at USD emerge?
Really very straightforward, because my wife and I said, all right, we're moving back to the East Coast, or we're staying in the Midwest. We're not considering anything west of Colorado. So of course we wound up in San Diego, right? I mean, that's super logical.
There's a recurring pattern of your strongest conviction, clearest plans going completely the opposite direction.
Yeah, this is, it's, and we were very serious about staying in the Midwest or going back to the East Coast. All of our family's back there, and I had interviewed for a position. I was a finalist in three or four other searches almost exactly at the same time, and we were thinking about where we would most like to be. Where did we think we would fit? What was a good place that would be a great cultural fit? And then at the tail end of that, University of San Diego, the position was advertised, and I remember calling my wife that morning, and she said, we were talking about, who's going to run to Target after work to pick up groceries, that sort of thing. And she says, oh, did you see the University of San Diego is looking for a VP? And I said, oh my God, I saw that 2 hours ago. And I said, what are you thinking? And there was this long pause on the phone. And she said, I think we should go for it. And we did. And the next thing you know, I just come out of a funeral for a Jesuit priest that we know, Dick Hauser, who had passed away. He was just this phenomenal guy, great professor. He wrote a few books. I mean, he was this very joyful guy. Was sitting in the parking lot. I literally had walked out of the funeral, and I was sitting there going, geez, what's happening with life next, and where are we going to go? And a 619 phone call came up on the screen in my car from San Diego. And it was Kai Snyder, who was co-chair of the search committee, and he said, we'd like to bring you out for an airport interview. And I was like, okay. And then we came here, and similar to the draw that I had with Tim Lannon at Creighton, Jim Harris, also an adept fundraiser, also an experienced administrator. This is Jim's third presidency, so he was not new to the game of what leadership is like in higher education. And I really wanted to come to a place where I would be able to learn from someone. And honest to God, that's how the experiences that we've had here, I feel very fortunate about, because I've learned a lot about higher education what it's like to run the institution, finances, handling crises, what it's like to engage in enrollment, in addition to all the fundraising stuff. And so it's been a great joy. And I got my doctorate while I was here, so there's just any number of things that have been very positive that have happened because of this experience. So I'm excited about all of that, grateful for all of that. We're working on a campaign right now. We just had a really big weekend, and so we're just, things are been quite fun. And even through pandemic, we were grateful we were in a place like San Diego just to be able to walk outside throughout the entire year and try and grab some sanity here and there.
Well, once in a while, you just cannot line up timing better than we have with this episode because 2 days ago, you all announced that the University of San Diego is receiving a $75 million gift, which is not only the largest gift in university history, but it's one of the largest ever given to any Catholic university. And I'm guessing, if I hadn't already pre-scheduled this meeting, I probably couldn't get this time with you because of how crazy it's been over the last couple of days. So first of all, congratulations. But the announcements, never tell the full story. So I'd love to know more just about that experience, being a part of something like that, the, I'm sure, complexity of both engaging multiple stakeholders while also being really careful about controlling the narrative and the announcement.
Right. There will never be enough good things that I can say about Darlene Shiley. So let me just start with that. And she is an amazing individual who is not a surprise to anybody who's ever been around her. Incredibly bright, very savvy business person, very savvy philanthropist. She was a performer in her younger days when she. When she met her husband, Donald Shiley. So she's sort of the consummate performer. She's got a very big personality. She's got a wicked sense of humor. I would call it wicked and biting sense of humor. I mean, she's just a lot of fun to be around. But she keeps everybody on her toes. She's had a very long relationship. She and Donald, before Donald passed away, they had a very long relationship with the university, and what attracted them to University of San Diego was values-based education. And so for her and for them, this was really about finding supporting things that they were very joyful and passionate about, whether it was our MFA students who, they're one of the top 15 MFA programs in the country, whether it was our undergraduate engineering school, the Shiley Marcos School of Engineering. Any number of things that they really felt like they were supportive of both the arts and STEM. And for her to make this gift at this time, she's really thinking about what the legacy that she and Donald sort of carry and what that will look like far beyond when she is no longer here. And making that investment so that at University of San Diego, we often talk about confronting our students come here to figure out how to confront humanity's urgent challenges. And for her, that's very personal. And this STEM initiative, this $75 million gift, is really all about supporting students from many different disciplines who will work on global issues and add to what the private sector will do, add to what the public sector will do, add to what the nonprofit sector will do in terms of making life better for others and creating new services, new products, new discoveries, new technologies, all of those. We have two NASA astronauts right now, Johnny Kim and Matthew Dominic. Matthew just came down. He was commander of the International Space Station, just came down. He's a Shiley Marcos Engineering School grad. When Darlene Shiley thinks about, when Mrs. Shiley thinks about, what are those things that are really going to change the world? She's thinking about individuals and students that she's met and seeing graduates. And we had this very fun moment Saturday night at this event we had at Petco Park here. And Matthew Dominic had videotaped a phone call with us that we played during the gale. So here he was on the space station saying, you know, congratulations on 75 years and go Toreros. And that was really something. Just to think about the type of talented people that we have here. And she felt really compelled to make sure that University of San Diego continues to be at the forefront of people who can go out and continue to change the world. And so, you know, for her, that's what this was all about. And it's very humbling. It's very humbling to see something like that happen. It's very humbling to see a very public announcement where she was very emotional to see and hear her emotion up close, and you know, to have the relationship with her that I do, that Jim Harris, president of the university, that you know, he and his wife Mary have a very close relationship with Mrs. Shiloh. You know, just it's a it doesn't happen in one day or one night. It takes for something like that to occur. In this case, it was sort of a lifetime of activity and relationship and being with someone and knowing what their passions are and their interests are and how they want to change the world. And she's done all that. So yeah, that was, I have to tell you, Brett, that was sitting there in the audience, knowing that it was coming, and there were only a handful of us that knew, waiting for that moment. And then the fireworks went off, and to see, you know, the emotion on her face and the tears that she, I mean, it was really something.
What an amazing inflection point and a jolt of positivity, and hopefully it creates even more momentum for you all to continue to build on. And it's also, you know, interesting because there's so many layers to the story you just shared, but the way that you're able to connect the big dollar value down to the individual impact stories and the relationships, that's what it's all about. And it also makes me wonder, right, as we are on this, you know, the investment is in STEM, right? We're living this incredible AI moment, the same way that there was a mobile moment in the, let's call it 2008 time frame, and the social
Right.
media of the mid 2000s that continues to accelerate. Now we're in this AI moment. It's November 20th. I'm sure today NVIDIA releases earnings. Everybody wants to know what's going on there.
Yeah.
And I think about all that, and then I think about Shirley, and I think about how do we weave together these different components of technology to
Yeah.
create more Shirley experiences sooner in the donor life cycle? Because there have to be, like you said, it's a lifetime of small moments that culminate into your night at Petco Park.
Yeah.
And most people aren't going to be able to engage at Shirley's level. And so, how do we lean on these new technologies to elevate their experience, even if they're deeper in the giving pyramid?
Yeah, it's funny. I had this moment of reflection, thinking about AI and machine learning, and thinking about what it was like for Darlene and Donald Shiley when they first got engaged with USD, right? So flashing back to when that was, and I wasn't around then, right? And so, but I, hearing the stories and reading some of the things, understanding what drew them in and what technology looked like at that time. And through the different phases of, you know, home computers coming in, and then, you know, going into the dot-com era and the technology with the mobile technologies with the phones, as you mentioned, you know, we've had these periods where technology has really grown exponentially. And what does that mean for us today? And how do we engage the Darlene Shileys and the Donald Shileys of today, knowing that they haven't reached that point for tomorrow? For every university, it's this moment looks maybe a bit different. And I can speak a little bit about how I think we're looking at this today and how we I think are hoping that we're engaging our alumni and our parents and our donors and friends of the universities in this dialogue, is that for us, we see this through Catholic higher education lens. And so it's not to proselytize about, hey, everybody should be Catholic. This is just really about a faith-based orientation and that people of all faiths and of no faiths are welcome here, right? But that faith is core to who we are, and who better to articulate some of the things at the moment from this particular vantage point than to talk about what does it mean to be human? Because that direct correlation, that juxtaposition between what does it mean to be human and AI and machine learning, those two things, I think we have to lean into both. And I think we have to think critically about both. And I think it really is going to force us to think about what is real and what do we have that animates us? What do we have that is going to drive business and drive education and drive government entities and AI machine learning for sure. But this human factor, we really need to lean hard into that. And that can be not just from a Catholic higher education perspective, but from public education and private education and from all of those places. I think looking at this problem from different perspectives, I think if we do that, we're going to find better answers. Are we going to be able to solve all of the things and concerns around AI? Of course not. But I think that if we really are honest with ourselves and start tackling those things together, then there can be some really good outcomes for society and for American life, and for folks beyond our borders. So for me, that is my hope, that we really do lean into understanding and grappling with this question of, what does it mean to be human? What is that all about?
Well, and I think, look, what you highlighted as well when you're telling the Darlene Shiley story as well, you said the word passions, right? Identifying passions. And I think there are just some fundamental elements of good philanthropic work and discovery that should be radically accelerated by this inflection point we're living through. For example, we are sitting on tremendous amounts of unstructured data, structured data, transactional data with metadata that can help paint a more complete picture of who every donor is and how they're engaged and what interests we might infer that in the past we would have been fully reliant on a human being to go and do that hunting and pecking, right? So if we can unlock that at scale and then also cross-reference that against the key funding priorities, what's happening at USD, what are the campaign initiatives, so that if I'm looking at Rick's profile or Brent's profile, I've got a running start as to the things we're working on, where our need is relative to everything we might infer about their interests, so that I'm coming with more context and recommendations than starting with a clean slate every time. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. I'm excited about this and excited for us to dive in and find better ways to, you think about the when you're describing this, the thing that comes to mind immediately is Amazon. And when you go to the Amazon site, and for me, I'm just going to out myself, because the ads that pop up on the sides are espresso machines, coffee grinders. Anything having to do with coffee, as you all can, I'm here. That's the stuff that pops up on the ads on Amazon pretty often. And so thinking about what the collegiate experience is like, right? And so knowing either from an enrollment perspective, when somebody comes on and we're doing some site tracking there, or when an alumnus or a parent comes on the site, figuring out a, and they're looking at stuff on the bookstore. Do we have the right technology, and not right now at the moment, to do follow-ups with them to say, saw you were looking at this, or if they were looking at an event, sporting event, can we invite them to participate on campus or get involved in athletic? They were looking at a business symposium here at the Canal School. So to your point, we have all of these things happening, and we have this data, often unstructured, and it's really our job to take advantage of it. And of course, from a fundraising and alumni relations perspective, that stuff is just, I mean, we're nervous on one hand, like, how do we handle data like that once we start to take advantage of using it. And but on the other hand, it's like very exciting because we'll be able to have hopefully more meaningful and engagements with folks, and also get to their interests and passion areas much more quickly, maybe than we have before, right? And so you're talking about all of this data that is there, and some of which is readily, maybe too readily available. And but you know, it's there for us to be working with, and we're not there yet. At least, you know, here, some
Look,
other places might be, but we're not.
and that's my point. It's like the Amazon example you gave is a good one. It comes up all the time. And if brands, you know, if organizations like that can monetize that intelligence, then philanthropy deserves to be able to do it too. Unlike Amazon, which is highly transactional in nature, this is the least transactional, especially as you move up the giving pyramid. It's the ultimate discretionary purchase. And that's where I think that like the Amazon, you know, framework is relevant, but how we then add the human element, the nuance, the fact that you're going to buy coffee one way or another, people are not necessarily going to give one way or another. That's where the human connection, the mapping of interest to passion to need can inspire somebody to be a $75 million donor who, with a different set of circumstances, could have been a non-donor. And that's what makes this so unique.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, I know we're coming up on time. So, what's next? You've just had this incredible inflection point. What's going on at USD? Are you hiring? Are you growing? Like, make the pitch for why people should go check out that career page.
Yeah, listen, I think people should, you know, we're obviously going to be doing a little bit of hiring for the campaign that we're working on right now. And you know, they should come here and work here. You know, our sustainability plan is in action, by the way. My lights just went off, so I'm going to wave my hands here to get it got back on. But you know, they should seriously consider coming to USD if they're at all mission focused around values-based education, whether they're Catholic or not, whether they're Muslim, Jewish. You know, we have a lot of great employees here from multiple and no faith traditions as well. And they should come work here because Lisa Fernandez works here, and she's amazing, and she makes this place great. And so that's my pitch. You know, we are a place that I think, as you alluded to, takes the work very seriously. But there are times when we thankfully do not take ourselves that seriously.
I love it. Well, Rick, look, you're active on LinkedIn. You've got a great presence there. Is it okay if folks reach out, or do you have a different
Yeah,
medium?
no, LinkedIn is a great place, Brent. And you know, I'm just I feel very fortunate to be in this place at this time. And Brent, I thank you for making the time with you know, your business and doing this sort of thing, because I think building community around these things and is very helpful. And I think there are a lot of shared experiences. So, you know, you carving out the time and thinking about, hey, what could we do that would add value to all of the work that we're doing and help bring sort of people together from very different places, I think is a great idea. So delighted that you're doing this.
I love it. And look, I'll say right back to you, Rick. You know, first of all, this has been, you know, launching the Raise podcast, it's been one of the best decisions we've made. It's been such a fun way to learn, to really understand, to share stories, to inspire other people who want to be a VP someday, who are now getting to hear your story and hundreds of other stories. But I'd also turn it back, you know, I think you and other VPs should be doing this. I think you'd be great at interviewing Darlene Shiley, interviewing other donors, right? Finding your own version of this to build your own community. And so my hope is that, you know, maybe there will be some secondary benefits of conversations like this one too.
Well, I appreciate the push and the charge on that. And now that I've finished my doctorate and I don't have homework anymore, I think I might have the mental bandwidth to be able to put my
I
head
love
around
it.
it. And
Well, you give me a call anytime if you want to walk through the step-by-step process. We can help get you going for sure. But today I would like to just say thank you. Congratulations on this amazing moment. We couldn't have timed it better. Wishing you nothing but continued success and look forward to learning together, especially as this AI era continues to accelerate. And so with that, I'll wrap today's episode with Rick Virgin, who serves as Vice President for university advancement at the University of San Diego. Thanks, Rick, and take care, everybody.
Brent, thank you so much. Bye, everybody.